I was the third ranked one-legged woman in the United States. I'm thinking if I just stay standing, I can win the gold. So I get in the starting gate, the race official counts down, 3, 2, 1, go. I get to where I can see the finish line and I think I made it. And that's when I hit the ice and I fell.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Famous Failures, where I interview the world's most interesting people about the failures they've had in their lives and what they learned from them. I'm your host, Ozan Morol. Before I introduce today's guest, I have a request from you. The podcast is fairly new, so I would really appreciate your help in spreading the word. You can do that in one of three ways. You can tell your friends about the podcast, you can subscribe to the podcast on whatever platform that you're listening on, or you can leave a review on iTunes or Google Play. In addition, if you'd like to keep in touch with me and say hello to me, you can subscribe to my weekly newsletter, The Weekly Contrarian. It has thousands of subscribers, and readers call it the one email I look forward to each week. So every Thursday, you'll get a list of tools, articles, books, and other gems that challenge conventional wisdom and change the way that you look at the world. You can sign up for that by going to my website, ozanmorol.com, or texting my first name, Ozan, O-Z-A-N, to 345-345. And if you sign up now, you'll also get a free ebook called The Contrarian Handbook, 8 Principles for Innovating Your Thinking. And again, you can get that right now on the go by texting OZAN to 345-345 or heading over to my website, ozanmorol.com. This week's guest on Famous Failures is Bonnie St. John. Bonnie is an Olympic medalist, best-selling author, highly sought-after keynote speaker, and a leadership consultant. Despite having her right leg amputated at age 5, Bonnie became the first African-American ever to win medals in the Winter Olympic competition. She took home a silver and 2 bronze medals at the 1984 Winter Paralympics in Austria. President Clinton appointed her as a director for human capital issues on the White House National Economic Council, and NBC Nightly News selected Bonnie as one of the 5 most inspiring women in America. Bonnie travels the globe these days as a highly sought-after keynote speaker, Fortune 500 business consultant, television and radio personality, and business owner. She's currently the CEO of the Blue Circle Leadership Institute, where she leads international live and virtual leadership programs. On top of everything else that she does, Bonnie is also the best-selling author of 7 books. Her most recent book is Micro Resilience, Minor Shifts for Major Boosts in Focus, Drive, and Energy. I highly recommend the book. You can find out more about the book and get yourself a copy at microresilience.com. In our interview, we covered quite a bit of territory. I was really blown away by this interview, by how open and transparent Bonnie was with her failures, in addition to giving really actionable, practical strategies that you can implement right away to move forward when you fall down. I hope you enjoy the conversation as much as I did. Without further ado, I give you Bonnie St. John. Bonnie, welcome to the show.
Thank you. This is such a great topic. I love this topic.
Thank you so much for making the time. I've been really looking forward to this conversation for several weeks now. You're so amazing on so many levels, personal, athletic, and professional. You've got so many accomplishments. But what about failures? What have been some of the most valuable failures that you've had in your life?
Well, I think this is such an important topic because kids today see so much on social media and they see everybody positioning their lives as perfect. And it's just not that way. And so when I speak to all kinds of groups, sometimes I'll show a slide of all my failures. The failure I'm most famous for is falling down at the Olympics. And I was the third ranked one-legged woman in the United States when I got on the team. And I was glad to make it because they only took 3 one-legged women on the team. So I just barely made it. Nobody expects you to beat your teammates, never mind anyone else, right? So I just went thinking, I'm going to race. I get to represent the United States of America. I was so excited. But in the first run of the slalom race, I went down the first run. And when the times were posted, I had the number one time in the world. So it was a complete upset. I had trained over summer on a glacier with 2-legged skiers. I had just outworked a lot of the competition. But it was an upset. And I was so excited. But you have to do a second run in order to get the medal. So I went back up to the top and waiting my turn. And I heard other women going ahead of me were crashing. So on the second run, there was this dangerous icy spot. I'm thinking, you know, no heroics here. I don't have to do anything crazy. If I just stay standing, I can win the gold. So I get in the starting gate, the race official counts down, 3, 2, 1, go. I'm hitting the red and blue poles. I get to where I can see the finish line and I think I made it. And that's when I hit the ice and I fell. You know, I was number one in the world and I'm sitting on my rear end in the snow. My mind wanted to give up to think, you know, oh no, I got to face my sponsors, you know, how disappointing. But my physical training was always to finish. So before I could think about it, my body got up, got over the finish line. When the dust cleared, I was still in third place. I won a bronze medal. You know, I thought game over. I thought I lost, but I got up quickly, got over the finish line, and still won the bronze medal. Now, I went on. I won another bronze in giant slalom, seventh in the downhill, a silver medal for overall performance. And you couldn't win the overall performance if you hadn't finished all the races, you know. So it was so important that I'd finish that race when I didn't feel like it. You know, thinking about it later, the woman who won the gold medal in that race, I was the better skier than her in the first run. When nothing went wrong, I was the best slalom skier in the world. In the second run, it wasn't that she didn't fall, she also fell. So how did she beat me? She only beat me by getting up faster. She was the quicker getter upper. So that has been such an, when you say, what is your most valuable failure? That has been such an important lesson to me of, it's not just that you fell down, it's how fast did you get up? Even in the midst of top competition, our ability to get up and get up faster makes such a difference. And so I have shared that failure over and over and over with so many people. Rosabeth Moss Kantor from the Harvard Business School says resilience is the meta skill. You know, that ability to get up faster is the key skill going forward.
And this experience, I think, gave rise to a quote of yours that was selected for printing on Nationwide Starbucks coffee cups.
They did a campaign of printing quotes, and it was, people fall down, winners get up, but sometimes the gold medal winner is just the person who gets up the fastest.
That quote is so simple, yet I think so telling about your attitude toward life and the importance of resilience, as you mentioned. So are there any strategies that you employ personally to get up faster when you're knocked down?
Wow, so many. I mean, my most recent book that I wrote with my husband, Alan Haynes, is about micro resilience. So it's about being resilient all the time. And people tend to think of resilience as a big thing, like recovering from cancer or a hurricane. But we're looking at, how can I just be more resilient this afternoon than I was this morning? And so lots of little things to be able to recover your energy and your focus, to be able to turn your attitude around after, you know, you have a difficult client situation or deadlines change and you can get knocked off your game. It can be something as simple as a first aid kit for your attitude. In the book, we talk about how to put together a first aid. And it's something you can do as a team building event because it gives you a shared vocabulary that says, hey, stuff is going to happen to you. Bad stuff is going to happen to you. Client can yell at you. Things can change. But you can turn your attitude back around again and get back in the game. So you can put together a first aid kit. It could have pictures of family. I have in my first aid kit a note from my mother that says, cherish yourself. And my mother passed away over 10 years ago. And so just seeing that note kind of, you know, helps put things in perspective. How important is that thing that just happened? You know what? I can regain my attitude, remember what's important, and go back into the next round with confidence.
I love the idea of maintaining a first aid kit. I have this practice of saving notes that I receive from students
or exactly.
Your emails from readers. And when I'm feeling down about myself, I open up that folder and read them, and that gives me the boost that I need to keep going.
And you can even put that on your phone and make it portable if you travel a lot. I think that's a great idea. I was talking about first aid kits in an after-school program with fourth graders, and I was giving them samples so that they could physically build their first aid kit. And one of the things I put in is a blank thank you note. I said, if you're feeling really down, write a thank you note to somebody else. And that's another way to turn your attitude around. But you have to decide, you know, what goes in your first aid kit, what works for you.
Absolutely. Have you had any other valuable failures in your life?
Well, actually, it's interesting thinking about valuable failures. Probably the most valuable failure that I ever had was that freshman year in college, I got turned down. I applied to be in an honors major. It's called social studies. I was at Harvard. And I got turned down to be in this honors major. And I decided after I got rejected that I would take second semester, freshman year, off, move out to Lake Tahoe and train and try to make the U.S. ski team. And, you know, had I gotten accepted to this really intense major that it required all this extra work, and I wouldn't have taken time off. I probably would have tried to keep skiing while I was at Harvard and but I wouldn't have put as much intensity in, and I probably wouldn't have made the team, and I would have gone on and done other things, and I wouldn't have known what I missed out on. But looking back, I look at that simple failure that is, you know, who knew? But because I failed at that, I went, you know what? I'm just going to take second semester off and go train. Isn't that crazy when you look back at how these decisions affect you?
That's amazing. And it feels terrible in the moment, right? It's only after the passage of time that you realize it was a blessing and a curse.
But I guess that's the message. And you said, you know, the story about me falling down at the Olympics and getting up, you said that's, to you, that sounds so endemic of what you know about me. But it's right. Freshman year in college, instead of getting depressed and saying, oh, I'm stupid and I got rejected, I went, huh, okay, I'll go do something else. And that's a really important attitude, right? One of the things I talked about in the book, Live Your Joy, that I wrote a number of years back, is having a portfolio of goals. And I came to that metaphor, honestly, by looking at how I had run my life and trying to explain to people how I did it, how I make decisions. And I said, I've always had a portfolio. And so you have some high-risk goals, some low-risk goals, some hard things, some stretch goals. And you adjust your energy that you're putting into them based on, you know, what's working. And just like you wouldn't put all your investment savings into one thing, you know, you diversify. I've always done that. And some people recommend, you know, you should have one goal, you know, and burn the boats behind you. And I said, you know, that's just not how I've run my life. And I joke, I come from a poor neighborhood. We never burnt anything. You know, we used everything and we had a plan B. And so people look at my life and I've done so many really different things. You know, I've been in sports. I've worked in the White House. I've published books. I run my own business. And they say, how have you done so many different things? And I say it's because I've had a portfolio of things I'm trying. And so many of those things in the portfolio fail. But nobody looks at the list of failed things. But there's no way you can do as many things as I've done. You know, you got to have a lot of up at bats. And that means you have a lot of failures. But hey, you know, if one out of five things succeeded and you did 50 things, you had 10 things go right. You know, so again, I think a lot of our young people don't understand that today. They look at somebody like me and say, you've just succeeded at everything. And I say, no, I really haven't. I've just been up at bat a lot.
And people remember the successes, of course, and not the failures. And I think this idea of building a portfolio of goals is important for resilience as well, because as you said, if you fail in one area, then you've got four other things that you're working on. And so it makes it easier for your mind to pivot quickly from failure in one area to focusing on success in a different one.
When I was in senior year in high school, I was at a ski racing academy. I was very focused on racing. I was training. I was surrounded by people racing, but I never stopped focusing on wanting to go to college. And then when I went to college, I said, well, I'm more focused on education now, but oh, well, that didn't work out. So maybe I'll do more skiing, you know? So it's rebalancing that portfolio on a regular basis. I never just did one thing.
And how did skiing make its way into this portfolio?
I know, it's crazy. The one-legged black girl from San Diego who ends up becoming a ski racer. A friend of mine in high school, Barbara Warmath, invited me to go skiing with her family when I was about 15. And I just think that's so amazing because she was white, I'm black. She lived in La Jolla. If you know anything about San Diego, it's, you know, what you see in the brochures when you read about San Diego. Beaches, you know, beautiful houses. I lived in National City, which is where there were gangs and there was no beach. It was shipbuilding and manufacturing and Navy bases. And it was not the beautiful part of San Diego. So I was bused across town to her part of the town. And, you know, here's how to say it. She turned to her one-legged black friend from the wrong side of the tracks and said, hey, let's go skiing. And she believed I could do it. We talk a lot about the importance of diversity now and that diversity makes us more competitive. And I think when you look at that story of what happened, you see it. Because if I hadn't been on the U.S. team the year I competed, we wouldn't have won as many medals. You know, the people behind me were not American. And so literally my being there made us more competitive. And yet, you know, would the U.S. ski team be out recruiting for black girls in San Diego? Not really. Diversity is by the fact that Barbara reached out and said, hey, let's go do this. And the fact that I was willing to be friends with somebody who was really different and try something that nobody did in my family. That's powerful.
That's very powerful. I'm seeing this with my own students as well, but I think we're getting more tribal, or at least it feels like it. You know, the country, not just the United States, but I think many countries are now divided more than ever across political, social, cultural, racial lines. So that's such an inspiring story. And I wonder, I mean, was this something related to your own background or Barbara's background, or your upbringing or Barbara's upbringing, or your education or Barbara's education, that helped you sort of reach out and connect despite these sort of, you know, the differences that you listed between your background and hers?
She's a great person. I mean, she went on and went in the Peace Corps. She's learned different languages. After she had children, she was living in a camp to help settle refugees. So refugees would come into this camp, and her family were working to help them resettle, get new skills and reorient, you know. And then now she lives in Chattanooga. She's an amazing person. And I know my mother raised us to be able to live in different worlds. But what I would say now, I think a practical thing to say about this, I saw you wrote a blog on you can't convince people of things by just burying them in facts.
Right.
And you said you've got to give people an out. I would go a little further. I would say it's really important to affirm other people, to help them to feel really good about themselves across differences, especially with all the tribal warfare that's going on, like you're saying. People assume that when you're different, you don't like them. And so it's almost like you have to prove that that's not true before you can make a connection that is going to allow any information to flow. So it's not just giving them an out, it's actually helping them to feel really good about themselves, and then they can have the grace to make shifts.
Sure.
I don't know if that's helpful. Is that helpful?
No, that's very helpful. And in your own personal life, how do you do that? So how do you make the other person with whom you might disagree feel good?
You know what the secret is? You have to learn about them. It was interesting because you were saying, you know, I did this. I am a kind of person who gets asked to move across boundaries a lot. I'm actually biracial. My mother was black. My father was white. I have one leg. I've come from a poor family, but I deal with a lot of high power people now, you know, so I cross a lot of boundaries. And I find When I'm going into a community that's very different than myself to give a speech or to do a presentation, I work first before I get there to learn as much as I can about them. And I find things that I really admire and respect about them. So, for example, I was in Utah giving a speech, and I'm not Mormon. And so I researched a lot. And one of the things, it was at BYU, one of the things I really respect is that they all go on missions. You know, that's not easy. And to choose to go to a college where you can't drink and you can't even drink coffee and tea, and there's restrictions on facial hair and how you dress, you know, to choose to go to a college that isn't free and easy, you know, they're doing that because they want to be a better person. So I found a number of things that I admired about them. Oh, and Mormons as a voting bloc are more supportive of immigrants than most other conservative Christian groups. And it's because they all go on missions. So they're very exposed to the world. So I found some things I could connect and admire and started there, and then gave them some challenges in terms of how they could be more inclusive.
I think that's great advice. I still do think, despite sort of the seeming climate in the country in terms of divisions and tribalism, that there is more that unites us than divides us. And I think what I'm hearing you say is that you start with on common ground. So find common ground.
And I think it's also take time to learn about people that are different than you. And often we stereotype people that are different than us, as opposed to really digging into who they are.
Sure. Or we approach each conversation with an agenda to persuade, to give other people advice, as opposed to just having a conversation for the sake of listening and learning and understanding somebody else's truth. That's a rare quality, but a really important one.
I value my role of getting to cross boundaries and meet a lot of different kinds of people and find those connections and help them see connections. So I think it's so important right now that we do that.
Has there been a failure that was particularly difficult for you?
I would say the most difficult failure that I've been through was getting divorced. And no one wants to get divorced. You know, failing at marriage is not something anyone sets out to do. It was particularly difficult for me because it was wound up with the fact that I had been sexually abused as a child for many years. I was abused from the age of 2 to the age of 7. When my daughter reached those ages, I nearly lost my mind because I had stuffed down a lot of the memories. I couldn't remember a lot of it. And then as my daughter hit those ages, I had to deal with it in a way that I hadn't dealt with, or else I couldn't be present. You know, it's the effort to push away the memories would be pushing away my daughter. And so I had to deal with a lot of that. And in the in the course of that, I ended up getting divorced as well. So it was a failure and an opportunity. How do you say opportunity when you don't have a choice?
Right.
I was forced to deal with my demons at the same time. So it was a really hard period. You know, I talked about getting up faster at the Olympics. This was not a period where I could just say, oh, I'm going to bounce back and get up faster. You know, so it was a period of my life that lasted at least 4 years that was just really painful and difficult. And I kept trying to bounce back, and I'd bounce back and it wouldn't work. And I'd bounce back and it wouldn't work. You know, it's like, that's tough.
You could go back in time and give yourself advice when you were navigating this really, really difficult situation. What would you say?
You know, I would say be more compassionate with yourself. But that was one of the problems, is having grown up as the abused kid, I was not compassionate with myself or anyone. And in the process of that, I learned compassion. I got more compassion. But telling myself at the beginning, be compassionate, would have been like, you know, dumping water on a turtle.
Sure.
Here's what I would say to anybody listening who is going through something similar, is I have won Olympic medals and I have gone through difficult emotional healing. Difficult emotional healing was harder. So if you are doing that, and so many of us are, with the opioid crisis and with, there's so many things, invisible things that people are dealing with. Give yourself an Olympic medal. You deserve an Olympic medal, and stick with it. Do the hard work. It is one of the, you know, it's the most important change I ever made in my life. So I am officially awarding you an Olympic medal for working on that.
I love that. I love that. Oh, that's so great. So you've written 7, if I'm counting the number correctly, 7 groundbreaking books on top of everything else that you've done in your life. How do you fail when it comes to writing?
Oh my gosh, there's so many ways to fail. First of all, I have to say, we've talked about a few of my failures. My failures are legion. You know, I have everything I do, I fail at. You know, when you go to get a book published, I got rejected many, 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 many times. You know, I can't even count how many times. And then even after I got my first book published, then you think, oh, it's going to be easy from there. After the first book was published, the publisher didn't want to publish another book with me. And it was a long time before I actually started publishing again. And that was a whole journey. And then writing, I mean, writing is so painful. You write and it's bad and you throw it out. Or even, you know, proposing, what is my next book I'm going to do? I'll do a proposal and throw it out, and do another one and throw it out. And you have to be willing to fail to write.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I feel like I fail every day when I'm writing.
But you have to be willing to throw something on the page and then say, well, that's not it, and move on and do the next thing. But if you're not willing to fail, you can't get to what's good.
And if you don't mind me asking, why did the publisher not want to work with you after your first book?
It just didn't do as well as they expected. To be honest with you, my first book was with Simon & Schuster back in the 90s. And later somebody told me, you know, Oprah Winfrey was really big doing her show. They had, this is going to sound so old-fashioned, but this was back in the 90s. They said they had, nobody ever put Black women's pictures on the cover of books. You just didn't do that because it wasn't going to sell. But in the age of Oprah, they got my story, they did my book, they put my picture on the cover, and they just hoped it would do well. And it didn't do as well as they had hoped. And they were like, they moved on to the next thing. That's an important part of this whole failure thing. You have to not take it personally. It's probably not about you. And so I had to work hard to get the next contract. It just didn't automatically come because my first one was a, you know, runaway bestseller. I had to work at getting the next one.
Right.
In fact, I self-published a couple of books, which was a great learning journey too. It's like, okay, that didn't work. I'll try this and, you know, I'll learn from that.
So, okay. So your first book was published with Simon & Schuster. And then after that, you started self-publishing before you published with a publisher again?
I did. I mean, actually, the first book I self-published was because, this is so great, everything's about failure. This is what we're going to discover from this conversation.
Fantastic.
So I was working on my first book with Simon & Schuster. It was called Succeeding Sane. So it was about being successful. And I had interviewed a number of people who were role models for me about being successful and having a good life at the same time. Everything that I wrote about children in the book, my editor deleted, cut out. Now, we can psychoanalyze my editor and why that was, but I looked at him and I said, are you sure you want to cut out everything about children? He said, yes. So I published it as a separate book. I thought, well, I think this is really important. So I actually that book actually came out self-published before the Simon & Schuster book came out. I sold it at events and things. It was called Getting Ahead at Work Without Leaving Your Family Behind. But it was the outtakes from my other book. Later, I self-published another book because I had gotten approached by a TV show to do inspiration and money. So I ended up publishing an inspiration money book. All of this is about just carpe diem, right?
Absolutely. And not taking it personally, as you said, which is so hard to do because especially with a book or even a business project, we identify with our products. You know, we wrote this thing, we came up with this business idea, we came up with this book, this is my idea, my project. And it becomes so hard to insert that distance between the idea that is rejected and ourselves. Because we assume that if our idea is rejected, then that's also a personal rejection, which I think increases the fear of failure. So then people don't do what they are thinking about doing. They don't write that book. They don't sing that song. They don't paint that canvas. They don't start that business.
To operationalize this, to give people a tool on this right. too, is in our micro resilience book, we quote Marty Seligman, who talks about being pessimistic. I love the way he says pessimism is he calls it learned helplessness. That when you're pessimistic, you are acting helpless. So here's a simple tool, is you can talk about PPP. When people are pessimistic, they tend to explain failures by saying they are personal, prevalent, or permanent. You've heard this before, probably, right?
I have, yes.
If you're explaining failures by saying they're permanent, it's always going to be that way. Well, if I didn't get another book contract, I guess that's the way it is. Well, no, I figured that might change. If I kept pitching, maybe I'll get another one. It's not personal. It's not about me. And it's not prevalent. It's not everywhere. So like if you lose your job and you say, well, you know, there's no jobs here, but I could move. But what's the point? It's the economy's bad everywhere. You know, so you just assume everything's bad everywhere. It won't change. And it's personal. So you become helpless if you start to believe that. And so the way you can switch that over is to do CCC instead of PPP. And that's asking yourself, what am I committed to? What are my values in this situation? Yeah, I don't like that I failed, but what are my values? What is the challenge? Well, how can I look at this as a challenge and something to be tackled? And what choices do I have? And that's really powerful. There's a lot of research around just remembering that you have a choice about anything is very energizing and helps you not to be helpless. So to say, not only do we have to not think failure is personal, but we have to also not think it's permanent or prevalent. And look, here's the three C's that you can do to try to shift your mindset.
That's great advice. And what was the name of the book again? The audience can find this strategy. Well,
it's quoted in Micro Resilience, my most recent book, and you can go to microresilience.com. There's videos there too. There's like 6 fun little videos to get some of these easy to use tools.
Excellent. Fantastic. And I'll include all of this in the show notes so our audience can find exactly what they need. How are you failing right now?
Right now we're running a really successful business. So my husband and I are business partners and our business is called Blue Circle Institute. You can go to bluecircleinstitute.com. And we run leadership programs for women's leadership programs, in particular for Fortune 100 companies. Micro Resilience is being turned into a train the trainer program. We already have customers in Thailand and here in the US that are using it as a train the trainer. So we're dealing with a lot of big corporate clients. And the good news is companies that have signed up for our women's leadership program, like always re-up and it's growing and growing and growing. But when you're pitching new clients, you know, you get no a lot, you know, so you get rejections and, you know, you could pitch 10 companies and get one that signs up or none that sign up. You have to be willing to fail. And maybe you don't, you know, our company's doing really well, so I don't have to see it as failure, but it still isn't easy. You know, there was one RFP that we did. We did like 4 presentations. We flew out. We did all these things. And they, in the end, they didn't do it. You know, so you have to be willing to stick your neck out, take risks, and hear no. This is a great message. I want to get this to people too, is I always thought the poor little girl from National City with one leg that if I could just go to Harvard, everything would get easier. Or if I could just be a Rhodes Scholar, everything would be easier. Or if I could just get those first speaking contracts, you know, everything would be easier. That doesn't happen. You still have to get up at bat, swing, miss sometimes, and move on. It never stops. Failure never stops.
I think that's a perfect note to wrap this interview on. I'm happy to give you an opportunity. You've shared already such actionable strategies and advice with our audience here, but I'd be happy to give you an opportunity if you have any parting words on failure that you'd like to share with the audience that we didn't cover already, please feel free to do so. And then also please let us know where people can find out more about you and your work.
You could go to microresilience.com. You can go to bluecircleinstitute.com. Those are two great resources. And what I would say as a last word is some advice that I got from one of my great mentors. He was a ski coach. He built champions. He's in the Water Skiing Hall of Fame for running college water skiing programs. He's in the Snow Skiing Hall of Fame. I got to go back and talk to him like 20 years after I was skiing. And when I was 17 years old, you know, I was asking him, how do I wax my skis? But 20 years later, I was asking him, you know, how did you build champions? How did you really change the game? And I just want to leave you with this one thought. As he said, I never built champions one at a time. I built communities of champions, because you can only push one person so far. But when you have a group of people who are pushing each other, sharing ideas, picking each other up when they fall down, everybody goes further. And so I guess what I would say is think about how do you build your own community of champions, because failure is hard. And we just said failure never ends. And so being able to surround yourself with people that stretch you and ask you the three C's, you know, what are you committed to? What are your values? What's your challenge? You know, people are always challenging you, pulling you into that more positive realm, but also helping pick you up when things go wrong and dust you off and get you back in the game. That's important. So think about building your own community of champions.
Thank you so much, Bonnie, for your time. You're such an inspiration. And thank you for being so open about your own failures and for sharing such practical advice with our audience on how to move forward and how to get up when you fall down. So thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for listening. Two things before you take off. First, if you don't want to miss out on future episodes of Famous Failures, please subscribe to the podcast on whatever platform you're listening on, and be sure to leave a review on iTunes or Google Play. Second, if you'd like to join thousands of others who receive a short email from me each Thursday with a list of articles, books, tools, quotes, and other gems that help you discover how extraordinary thinking produces extraordinary results, you can text my first name, which is Ozan, that's spelled O-Z-A-N, to 345-345. So once again, that's my first name, Ozan, O-Z-A-N, to 345-345. Or if you're in front of your computer, you can head over to ozanvarol.com and drop your email address. If you act now, you'll also get a free ebook called The Contrarian Handbook, 8 Principles to Innovate Your Thinking. As always, thank you for listening and see you next time.